KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Today on this last show of the winter quarter, I'm very excited to have on Dan Trottier, postdoctoral fellow in social and digital media at the University of Westminster Communications and Media Research Institute. He is the author of a book that I came across a short while ago, called Social Media as Surveillance, Rethinking Visibility in a Converging World. Dan has written a very interesting study, both based on theory as well as empirical analysis, of not only how social media is used, but the ways that social media is creating what Jeremy Bentham famously and now often quoted called the panopticon. But his focus is particularly on Facebook in particular and social media more broadly, and considering what we mean by visibility and what we mean by interaction with others in the context of social media and how social media operates. This notion of surveillance is one that has become increasingly important as data is shared freely by individuals with social media entities. And, of course, prior to social media, this same data was being shared somewhat unwittingly through banks and other entities where that information became aggregated and that data became useful and has become useful to commercial entities, to nonprofits, to governments, and to a variety of other organizations. And so the question of how data is used on the internet, how data is used in technology, what your privacy as an individual's rights are with respect to that data, are all topics that are becoming increasingly important. Social media, of course, is at the center of that, and we've spent on several shows on Hearsay Culture over the last several years discussing Facebook and social media with a variety of scholars. Here in this book, Dan is taking a close look at this notion of surveillance with social media at the center. The idea of the book, and we're going to talk about it, is again this empirical ethnographic research where Dan conducted interviews with a number of Facebook users and social media users to get a sense of their sense of what rights they have vis-a-vis privacy and what rights they have vis-a-vis the surveillance that exists and the monitoring practices in social media. So the book takes a wide role and wide view of these issues, but it does show that these various motivations for being involved in social media, from connecting with others to promoting yourself to sensing what others are doing, right, the notion of lurking on social media where one doesn't necessarily post much but observes others, all come towards a, again, panopticon idea that we are going to be watched by each other. And we will be watched perhaps by governments, by corporations. We may not know that we're being watched. We may not know how much we're being watched. And in that way, social media becomes a very effective tool of surveillance. As I was reading Dan's book, I was reminded of a very prescient, as is often the case, Onion article where the Onion was writing about testimony from a fictional CIA director who was noting how well Facebook has operated as an intelligence gathering tool operated by the CIA. And that notion, while somewhat extreme, is actually not that far-fetched considering what social media is capable of doing. So Dan is joining us from London, England via Skype. We're recording the show on March 21st for airing on the same day. Dan, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's start off, Dan, with a background question I ask most of my authors. Tell us more about your background and why you decided to focus on social media and surveillance.
My academic background is primarily in sociology, so I've been mostly in sociology and sometimes communication departments. I got interested in surveillance studies when this topic was introduced to me in graduate school in a course, and it just struck me as a really relevant way to not only to make sense of the social world, but to make sense of the way that we use information technology, this idea of, you know, making ourselves very visible and putting ourselves on display. With social media specifically, and sort of the focus of the book, I started my PhD right around when Facebook was opened up to the public and also launched the news feed around like September 2006. And I have actually just joined Facebook at the time too. And it was interesting to see I mean, that sort of mix of excitement and unease among its user base, and also to see that user base grow rather exponentially. So it just seemed like sort of a natural thing to follow.
The idea of social media is one that, of course, we're still grappling with. And as you think about this book, and we're going to get into more details in a moment, who is your target audience? I mean, you write this book based upon empirical research, theory. Who are you writing the book for?
In that the book is based on my dissertation, I guess it's sort of indirectly targeting academics, mainly because they're usually the ones who have the patience to put up with that kind of writing style. But I think, I mean, with some of the interview data, and it was a real treat to be able to talk to different populations about social media. I would invite anyone to make use of that. So the book is primarily for academics, but I mean, in other pieces I've written and in other talks I've given, I've tried to sort of open it up to policymakers, to concerned members of the public. I guess the book is primarily for academics for that reason.
Now, we'll get into some of the weeds in a moment, but I want to define some terms. The subtitle of the book is Rethinking Visibility in a Converging World. So I do want to ask you some academic-y questions, although I think that they frame our discussion. What do you mean by visibility?
Well, I use the term visibility in addition to surveillance, and I guess, I mean, I use privacy as well, but the reason why I wanted visibility itself to be so visible is I think that's a more salient way to make sense of some of like the surveillance-based issues. So visibility is a way of making sense of information flows within the technology we use. So the way in which our personal information and content on Facebook makes us visible, I think that's maybe a more productive conversation to have than one on privacy. Not that I don't think privacy, you know, it has its place, but I think visibility is more relevant here.
So let's parse that a little bit, because, you know, one would, I think, colloquially say that privacy is, in a sense, the flip side of visibility. Is that not an accurate statement in your view of the relationship between visibility and privacy?
Yeah, I mean, you could talk about sort of what's public and what's private, what's visible, what's invisible. But then I might put something on Facebook that I want to be visible to a group of people. And then when it leaks beyond that, I would consider that to be a privacy violation. So you have the public, but you still have a sense of some kind of contextual privacy.
A couple of other phrases you use and words, and I want to come back to this idea of visibility. Again, a converging world. The cover of your book has a schematic of a circle that says social network, and then a variety of other circles with arrows connecting them showing individuals. Is that the concept of the converging world, or more specifically, what is it that's converging?
Yeah, the cover art I should mention was sort of selected after the fact. It's not interpreted too literally.
Right.
But the reason why I use the term convergence is because on the one hand you have software like Facebook that, you know, performs a lot of functions at once in our lives, and we often use it on devices like smartphones, which themselves do the work of like 10 devices from 10 years ago. And as a result, you know, these technologies, I think they mark a convergence of different social functions. You know, we use them to communicate, to express ourselves, to find out about the world. And as a result, different life spheres, different aspects of our personal lives, but our social world are converging on these platforms. And I think that creates some consequences in terms of what's visible, that, you know, produces a bit of discomfort at the personal level, but raises some other questions, you know, at the societal level.
So let's lastly define another term that you use, and it's one that I hadn't come across per se in other works, but an interesting one. You refer to a growing field or a nascent field of surveillance studies. What is surveillance studies?
Surveillance studies, it's an interdisciplinary field, and it's come out of I mean, mostly sociology and criminology, but there's also people in law, in computer science, in political studies, in urban geography, who are all concerned with these kinds of questions of, you know, are we living in a surveillance society? What's happening to people's personal information? So it's, I mean, it came out primarily from the UK and to a lesser extent Canada, but now you have departments or scholars across the world who are, you know, explicitly looking at surveillance as opposed to looking at it in consequence, I guess.
Let me ask you this, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but by way of allowing for greater research, are there individuals or scholars that you would put as founders or leaders in the field? And of course, recognizing that there are a lot of people doing good work, are there a couple of names that come to mind to you as people who are considered leaders in the field, particularly for those who want to learn more about surveillance studies as a separate discipline?
Sure. I'm likely to forget a few names now. So
of course, and I understand. Yeah.
But I think one of the key figures would be David Lyon, who is my PhD supervisor. He's based in Kingston, Ontario. So he sort of, I think, is one of the major living figures in this field. In the U.S., you have scholars such as Gary Marks, who looks at policing, undercover policing, and also surveillance studies. You have people like Oscar Gandhi who look at issues of like social sorting and the way different populations are treated differently. In the UK, you have people like Clive Norris who have looked at not only policing but also the impact that CCTV, closed-circuit television, has had on policing. Those would be, I think, some of the major figures who at least influenced my entry into surveillance studies.
So when we talk about surveillance studies, and I'm going off both what you have in your book as well as what you just said, are we thinking of surveillance in this sense as government surveillance, or is it a broader area than that?
This field, I think, started off with government surveillance. So both, policing, but also bureaucracy and, even things as mundane as like record keeping and censuses would be included here, the building of a population. In recent years, and especially with the emergence of social media, there's been an interest in more interpersonal surveillance, but also how marketers take advantage of surveillance. So things like loyalty cards or like big data. So as I think the technology and the opportunities for surveillance have grown and ended up in the hands of various groups and institutions, so too has an academic focus kind of spread to those areas.
We're chatting with Dan Trottier, author of the book Social Media Surveillance, A Rethinking Visibility in a Converging World, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Most listeners, particularly as this show airs in the Bay Area, are familiar with Facebook. So I'll dispense with those basic questions and then kind of dig in a little deeper. Other than Facebook, which is the focus of your book, where do we see pervasive surveillance in modern society? So, in other words, and I'll start at this top level, is the Internet itself, in your view, an instrument of surveillance?
Yeah, in that it's a matter of, inputting, often personal information about ourselves or, unwillingly telling the Internet things about ourselves through, like, our browsing habits, what we search. We're building up all this information from which it's quite easy to profile people. Technologically, it's clearly possible to do this. You can take certain measures to encrypt and to protect your information, but then there's always ways around that. I think it's Bruce Schneier had an interesting piece in CNN on the website last week, just basically saying that, yeah, we are, the Internet is basically part of a surveillance society.
So that gets us, a little further along here. As we think about the notion of surveillance, let's start off at a top level. Describing Facebook as a surveillance entity, what is that description? How would you describe Facebook in that way?
I guess you know, in terms of its basic architecture and what it does, like its MO, you know, it exists to collect and distribute personal information about us. And then not to knock that, I mean, that's why I use it. That's why, you know, grandmothers use it to stay in touch with their children and grandchildren. It's not entirely a negative thing, but we have to acknowledge that that's what's going on.
Well, but I guess the question is that what's going on? In other words, Facebook itself would say, if I had a Facebook representative here, that this isn't about surveillance, this is about networking. Are those different concepts?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, Facebook would probably not use terms like surveillance and probably not even something like visibility necessarily, unless you're talking about the visibility of a small business. And I think surveillance itself is a very loaded term. So we often think about, you know, like border crossings or, you know, Stasi or things like this when we think of surveillance, where, you know, networking, you know, that's definitely what's going on. But at the same time in that, it's the asynchronous collection of information. You know, you put up something on Facebook and then you don't really know who saw it, but it's out there. That in itself is a form of interpersonal surveillance. And at the same time, that could also be used by marketers, as it is. It could be used by law enforcement. It could be repurposed for so many different ends that it is networking. And I see why, of course, the term surveillance might not be very popular among Facebook employees, but that's also going on.
And I guess, you know, and again, you know, to push on this point, you know, and again, you know, imagining, you know, Facebook's response here, another pushback, would be on the notion of Facebook as a surveillance entity that look, surveillance, implies, at least to me, implies the idea that one is being watched without their permission, perhaps without their knowledge, and they almost can't opt out of it. Whereas Facebook is clearly voluntary, right? No one is required to be on Facebook. Now, you know, practically speaking, certainly in my case, for example, as a professor of intellectual property and internet law, you know, a good, at least half of the contacts I have on Facebook, I know professionally. And so in that sense, it's certainly not a requirement, but it's helpful to me professionally to be on Facebook. But as a general matter, I could opt out of Facebook and have my data, and of course that's a separate question which we'll talk about shortly, have my data no longer accessible that way, and I'm no longer being surveilled. Response?
Well, in terms of the voluntary nature, it's true that no one's being held at gunpoint to join Facebook, but in my interviews, and then anecdotally, like just talking to other people, everyone I've spoken to who's joined Facebook, they've joined it because of other people. They were sort of, you know, there's kind of a soft coercion going on there, or a kind of peer pressure where, you know, if all your friends are there, you know, you're almost feeling obliged to join. And everyone I've spoken to who's quit Facebook, if they didn't go back within a week or a month because, you know, the fear of missing out, they would start to notice that, you know, there were certain costs associated with not being on Facebook. Like you miss out on certain social interactions. You're not invited to certain events. So it is voluntary, but there's a certain, you know, heavy-handedness to that voluntary aspect. And in terms of, you know, consenting to put in information out there, I might put something up there with a certain audience in mind, like maybe 5 or 6 friends, yet I've got maybe closer to 500 friends, and I don't always think about all 500 friends. Moreover, Facebook's privacy settings might change overnight, as they often do, and then maybe I'm exposed in a way that I didn't consent to, or maybe, you know, Facebook decides to repurpose my information in the interest of national security or in the interest of monetizing that data. And even if I signed consented legally to that through the terms of service, you know, many users probably don't have a proper handle of those terms.
So, So given all of that, I guess the logical conclusion has to be that Facebook itself is perhaps taking advantage to some degree of people's willingness to share information with it, that is Facebook, because they see or they feel that there are benefits associated with giving up a certain degree of privacy and acceding to a certain amount of surveillance. And I guess, you know, the question then becomes, in and of itself, is that a bargain about which you're concerned?
Yeah, I mean, what concerns me with that is, I think most users see both ends of that equation, where on the one hand, everyone likes to complain about Facebook from very, inconsequential things like, changing the interface, to these, I would argue, more important questions like, what's happening to our information? How might this harm us? How might this harm our families or our communities? At the same time, you know, we still like using it, and it does, you know, it's come to serve a very vital function in our lives. And I think sort of framing that as a trade-off that, well, in exchange for this service, I'll just sort of take these risks and whatever, I think that overlooks the fact that, you know, we could petition for something better, or we could migrate to another platform. You know, things could be differently. And we see they're changing anyways, you know, as Facebook expands its business model and changes its interface. So why are we just being led along for the ride?
So let's talk about that in terms of Facebook and its structure. Since again, I mean, while social media is perhaps broader than Facebook, obviously Facebook is the major player right now, and that was the focus of your book. You know, how much do we know about the surveillance activities of Facebook? In other words, there's suspicions, and of course, you know, Facebook obviously doesn't hide the fact that it uses your data to send targeted advertising and what have you. But you're talking about, much more obscure or unknown practices. So at a top level, how much do we know about what Facebook is actually doing with our data from a surveillance standpoint?
Well, and that's the irony of it, is that a service that makes our lives so transparent, itself, its own practices are quite intransparent. So at the marketing end, we've seen over the past few years, the different, advertising platforms and marketing services that they've introduced. And there's always a pushback against that, but Facebook seems to be quite, persistent on this. So speaking to people who've developed like third party applications and other sort of ways of engaging with Facebook users, on the one hand, you get the sense in which they're actually quite precarious too. A lot of times, you know, they can only access a certain amount of information from users, and that can change overnight. So then they might, you know, they don't have a proper grasp, in many cases, especially like smaller businesses. Yet, you know, this resurfaces every now and then, stories about, you know, how much information is actually gleaned from Facebook by marketers. Now, what I've been concentrating on lately is how police and law enforcement and other intelligence services use Facebook. And it's quite remarkable to see the different ways in which they can engage with that data. So they can go to Facebook directly with a subpoena and request information. What surprised me is that, you know, when I was doing research in Sweden, I found that if a Swedish police officer wanted to get that information, they would have to go from like the Swedish National Police to the Department of Justice in the U.S. to the FBI to Facebook and then back. So that request can take 6 months. So you have those kinds of logistical issues that complicate this. Yet at the same time, they could just do something like lawful interception, where they would just capture that information sort of as it's being transmitted from the service provider, from, you know, the ISP, and just reconstruct it that way. So there are different ways in which they can capture this information, and based on privacy settings or based on what, you know, Facebook consents to giving out, it seems like there's no real limit to, broadly speaking, to what kind of information law enforcement can obtain from Facebook.
We're chatting with Dan Trottier, a postdoctoral fellow in social and digital media at the University of Westminster's Communication and Media Research Institute, author of the book Social Media Surveillance, Rethinking Visibility in a Converging World on KCSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KCSU, a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you. You can make a donation to KCSU by emailing our underwriting department at underwriting@kcsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kcsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kcsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KCSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So, Dan, let me ask you this, and this is something that literally came up this morning as I was heading out. On a major road here in Greensboro, North Carolina, a city of about 275,000 people, a billboard, this is a classic, old-style roadside billboard, suddenly popped up. I mean, they've been building it for a while, but there's a message on the billboard. And the billboard says, and I'm reading it verbatim, Michael, GPS tracker, $250. Nikon camera with zoom lens, $1,600. Catching my lying husband and buying this billboard with our investment income, Visman account, priceless. Tell Jessica you're moving in, Jennifer. And so this is a billboard, right, that is on the side of a road. And, of course, through Facebook, pictures of this billboard are now being circulated all over the planet. In fact, this morning I noticed that it was on one of the major news channels here in the United States. From a surveillance standpoint, of course, this is a choice. I mean, and I'm going to assume for purposes of this question that this information is accurate. In other words, that there actually is a Michael and Jennifer and that this issue exists as opposed to some kind of marketing ploy or something else, although it's not clear whoever did this, if it's marketing, didn't do a very good job except maybe to sell Nikon cameras or GPS trackers. Be that as it may, what makes this kind of activity, right, a classic billboard exposing very private information different than Facebook from a surveillance standpoint? Or is this a very, real example of the kinds of concerns we might have vis-a-vis Facebook?
I'd say, that's part of a broader culture in which, people, suspect their spouses of cheating on them and, hack into, their boyfriend's or girlfriend's email accounts. So I'd say it's sort of an extension of that kind of surveillance culture you'd find on Facebook. And it seems like it sort of weaves very in and out of Facebook in the sense that this wife, if she does exist, probably, found evidence of it, in addition to these other sort of technologies, probably also found some evidence on Facebook that maybe set off her suspicion. And then, as you pointed out, this billboard then ended up back on Facebook. So I'd say it's, Facebook itself isn't a separate kind of surveillance culture, but it's just, part of the toolkit that a suspicious spouse might use.
And so this gets to the concept that you also write about, and I'm curious about it because perhaps this is an example of it. You talk about something called surveillance creep. What is surveillance creep?
That's it's something similar to function creep, which is when technology that was designed with one purpose in mind and accepted by the public for that purpose is then used for a secondary use. So if my conversations with my friends on Facebook are then used to assess whether or not I'm part of a target demographic, for a new COLA, or to determine if I'm a good job candidate, or if I'm a national threat, those are examples of surveillance creep.
So is it fair to say then, and again, I want to extend this question involving the billboard a little bit, to the extent that again, assuming that all this is accurate, that Jennifer has accessed information in a way that sounds like surveillance, right? The presumption is that, the camera with the zoom lens was used to take photographs. Obviously, it appears that the GPS tracker was used, in one way or another to track this individual's movements, that we have the prototypical example of surveillance creep as you describe it. And the question is, does Facebook and the existence of social media make this behavior somehow more acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I would say it makes it more acceptable. I'd say it makes it more pervasive. And then if it's that much easier for spouses or lovers to creep on each other, or for, strangers to do this with each other, I think then it kind of forces us to come face to face with that and perhaps accept it. So it's definitely more pervasive, but based on how it's also seen as a social problem, I'm not sure if it's more accepted.
Well, let me ask the question a little bit differently, and I hear what you're saying. I mean, to the extent that Facebook has and others have talked about this, and you certainly mentioned in the book as well, to the extent that Facebook attempts to condition its users towards more and more publicity, less privacy, and I know you have concerns about those words, but I'll use your words, right, towards more visibility and less obscurity, for example. Is this billboard a logical extension of the general notion that people are becoming acclimated towards private information being made very public?
Yeah, it's interesting because the billboard itself, I mean, will of course have a bigger audience than like a network on Facebook of, 500 friends. More people are driving by that billboard, yet it's, in a sense, it's the same logic. And if an image of that were to go viral and then end up on the news, I mean, that's just sort of, you see a kind of like the progressive expansion of visibility. So in a sense, I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg didn't intend for those kinds of things to happen, like that billboard. But if you have a platform that makes personal information visible to, a social network and beyond your immediate social network, then, yeah, I mean, that's one of the consequences.
We're chatting with Dan Trottier, author of the book Social Media Surveillance, Rethinking Visibility in a Converging World on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Dan, you talk about a few other issues which I do want to touch on in this interview. And one is this notion of control and ownership. And that's another big issue on Facebook and a big issue that of course is the focus of a number of scholars' work and policymakers deciding, who owns this information and who should control it. With regard to personal information, what is your view as far as Facebook's rights or the rights that they should have with respect to owning and controlling data provided to it by its users?
Of course, Facebook performs a service, and one that I think a lot of people value quite highly. And so Facebook should perhaps have I don't want to say control, but, in that they're providing the service, they're a business, they should be somehow rewarded for that, I guess, in a very general sense. But what really concerns me is that users have a sense of control or a sense of ownership over their profile and their pictures and their personal information. And that doesn't match up to the legal situation. And it's that sort of disparity between how we perceive Facebook and our actual grasp over it that concerns me. And really the way the legal terms seem to mutate over time, and the fact that there is a real lack of transparency and a lack of visibility of, what the kind of control Facebook has over its information. So in the first instance, I'd want to see more of a like mutual transparency. So if this platform has my information and makes me much more visible, then I should at least be able to see what they're doing with it and what, not only what they're planning to do in the long term, but just what's possible right now.
So that gets to another issue that I want to spend some time on. It's an issue that we focused on a bit on hearsay culture, but it's also a personal interest of mine in terms of my own work, and that's the issue of transparency. And I'm not going to talk. I don't want to discuss right now issues involving things like trade secrecy and the fact that Facebook claims trade secrecy over information that might arguably be more of a public interest. Although Facebook, I'm not sure if I'd put at the level of a public utility or infrastructure like, let's say, a voting machine, where I have severe concerns about trade secrecy. But you write in a book that the appearance of transparency is much more important than actual transparency. You're quoting one of the individuals that you interviewed. What does that mean? And let's start at the top level. How does transparency play a role in regulating and understanding this surveillance society and social media as part of it?
Well, transparency, I mean, it's this really catchy term when, especially in a lot of the business literature about, like, you know, radical transparency and the naked CEO and all this kind of stuff about, you know, it being good for businesses if there's this kind of, you know, very radical visibility of business practices. This was sort of the call that was coming out a few years ago. And why that quote, you know, really resonated with me about how the appearance of transparency is more important is that, of course, you know, people, businesses putting this into practice realized, well, you know, if we put personal details, or, you know, we just kind of speak freely, in a very visible way, more often than not, that's going to harm us. So we have to be very strategic about this visibility. And it almost seemed like it was more of a PR effort than anything else in terms of, you know, giving the impression that that a business is being transparent. And I think, I mean, this is sort of a trend you find with all sorts of technologies. When they come out, there's always a sense in which they're going to drastically change, you know, relations between businesses and you know, their markets, or between institutions and individuals. And by and large, you just see sort of the reproduction of the same kinds of relations. So, you know, businesses might sort of hear this appeal to be transparent and then do it in the most meticulous, strategic, and very public relations-oriented way possible, and not, you know, as transparent as, say, you and I would be on Facebook.
So how is it that the appearance is more important than actual or functional transparency?
Well, I guess, you know, what a business wants to do on social media isn't the same as what an individual wants to do on social media. They want to be visible, but in the same way that they would be visible in a commercial or on a billboard. Of course, they want to, you know, I also talk about this idea of, like, conversations with users and having that kind of dialogue. But even that's more of, like, a best of both worlds. So, you know, combining the best features of getting your brand out there with, you know, listening to users, but, you know, maybe not taking in everything, maybe just, you know, seeing what's of relevance to the business and sort of just nodding in agreement to everything else.
We're chatting with Dan Trottier, author of the book Social Media as Surveillance, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Dan, we have about 12 or 13 minutes left, and so I start getting to the point here where I'm asking what I call the unfair questions, questions that you may not have enough time to answer adequately, but I ask them anyway. So here we go. In terms of this surveillance creep, which I think we are still talking about here, where in your view is it currently happening? Where do you see surveillance creep as, you know, this bleeding of these kinds of practices outside of social networks into other practices occurring? You've mentioned policing. The book talks about national security. Are there other examples right now where you have concerns about surveillance and these kinds of practices creeping into areas that heretofore have not been a focus?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to policing and national security, one thing that really strikes me now, especially as, you know, sites like Facebook have been around for almost 10 years and, you know, users have built a very extensive presence on these sites, the fact that if you take that body of information, you can make certain predictions about someone. So there's been cases where, in the case of job interviews, someone would go on and scan through a candidate's social media presence, their tweets, their status updates, and then analyze, whether or not they might have certain personality issues or whether or not they can be considered as trustworthy on the basis of that information, which in addition to all the methodological issues there, is a Facebook profile a good measure of, someone's personality? There's also, all sorts of ethical and legal issues. I think Facebook came out and said that this is breaching the terms of and conditions. There's also been cases where, this is sort of almost creeping into to the realm of science fiction, but the idea that you can take someone's tweets and then if you have enough of them, you can then produce like reasonably similar tweets. So, if I were to pass away and then someone wanted to continue my Twitter stream, they could sort of do that. So what we're able to do with information on that scale, I think we're still coming to terms with that. And, it dips into the realm of science fiction, yet it's happening right now. So that's one concern.
Are there concerns that you think policymakers should take more seriously but are not? I mean, privacy has been, a focus of the law for a long time. Of course, policymakers arguably spend too much time focusing on national security or at least writing laws involving national security when current laws might be adequate. Are there areas where you think policymakers need to be thinking about these issues but are not?
One thing that concerns me is how it's always a matter of focusing on one issue, and that often comes at the expense of others. So when talking about something like cyber stalking or bullying online, usually that's done in a way where it assumes that that's the only thing that's happening on social media, and that there are, that in a sense you can't have a conversation about cyber stalking without also thinking about the other kinds of surveillance that are taking place in terms of marketing, in terms of national security, especially in the terms of, what kind of changes you're proposing to that platform. So just coming to terms with the fact that these sites are in themselves a kind of social universe, I think, is important. But also, as I said before, coming to terms with the long-term consequences of life on social media. I get the feeling that policymakers are still, as we all are still thinking about this as a relatively new phenomenon, when in fact, they've been here long enough to have a pretty detailed archive of our lives. And even though we're always wondering if Facebook's going to be a flash in the pan or what's going to be the next Twitter or whatever, I think it's reasonable to say that these kinds of sites are here to stay. And so I think coming to terms with that is also important at the policy level.
One concern that I have, and particularly as reading this book, and you just kind of got to it, is having these archives of your life that can be aggregated in ways that we don't expect. And I got involved with social media in my mid-30s. But you've got now children, right? Minors who are engaged in social media at an extreme level where they post a lot of information that adults might not post, or at least many adults might not post. And in fact, their social networks are replicating in many ways the actual life networks that they have, i.e. neighbors, right? And their friends, they're communicating with them in school, they're in classes together, and they're also communicating them via social networks. And Facebook, again, is able to take advantage of the sharing of all that data. Do you have any concerns about minors involved in social media, particularly given the research that's been done recently by people like Gary Small and others, showing literally that the physiological status of the brain in a minor may not be able to make all of the rational calculations that one needs to make to decide what information should be shared and what shouldn't. Any thoughts about minors and Facebook given the existence of this surveillance society?
Well, first of all, like yourself, I joined these services later on in life, and I have to say I'm really grateful that Facebook and other services weren't around when I was a minor. So I agree it's definitely a concern. And especially this sense of, these young users might consent to putting this information up there at a certain point in their lives, to a specific audience. And first of all, they might regret that immediately and say, oh, why did I put this picture up there? Why did I say that? I want to take that back. And in some cases, that's not possible. Other users can do like a screen grab of that. So you know, very temporary mistakes can become very permanent. But then, yeah, there's also this sense in which young users are bound to the same terms as, you know, consenting adults are. And, you know, if you were talking about, like, alcohol or voting or sex or joining the army, that wouldn't be the case. And I'm not pushing for, like, a moral panic approach and saying, you know, we should get young people off Facebook. But we should acknowledge that, you know, if someone went through their adolescence and all the mistakes and all sort of, you know, the ups and downs of that life stage, doing that on in a very visible way on Facebook raises a lot of concerns that I think we're only going to face in consequence now. We're going to see sort of some of the issues that come up when these young users are applying for jobs or, you know, just trying to get on with their lives. It'll be really curious to see, you know, what a 10-year high school anniversary will be like when that high school experience itself was heavily Facebooked.
And indeed, where those separations that generally exist or often exist between individuals after they graduate high school aren't that nearly that separate because of the continual contact. You know, that, and again, you know, in the last several minutes we have, I do want to continue with this issue of children. You know, my own use of Facebook, I really do limit it to interactions with adults. In other words, one of my primary concerns about the use of social media is literally the loss of things like innocence. You know, boundaries between what is adult information and adult activity and what is not. You know, I have two boys ages 3.5 and 6. And despite my interest in the internet and technology, I have severely limited their contact with the technology because quite frankly, I don't think A, they need it right now. And need, of course, is a judgment call on my part. But more importantly, I don't think they're ready. And even with, teenagers that, you know, are family members, I severely limit my interaction there. Because again, it seems like we have blurred the line between what is appropriate, based upon a parental judgment for children and what is not. Facebook, to me, appears to very clearly take advantage of that blurring and again, use it in ways that, as you write about, look like surveillance. Is it fair to say that Facebook is, in fact, surveilling children?
I mean, by definition of what Facebook's doing, you know, soliciting personal information from young users, sort of sorting that out, making it into profiles, and then putting it on display. I mean, that's that seems to me like surveillance. To be fair to Facebook, too, they also put a lot of effort into identifying and culling information that's objectionable, that, you know, would violate their terms or would just otherwise be offensive or harmful. So it's not entirely toxic, but then in this more mundane sense about, you know, children just putting up, you know, information that they would otherwise put in a diary or pictures that would otherwise belong in an actual physical photo album. This sense in which that it's now seen as a place to put all this information without really thinking about what's going to happen to it later on or who else can see it. I think there is something there that, you know, if I was a parent, I'd be very concerned about that as well.
I, again, by way of personal practice, have stopped, and this is a few years ago, stopped putting at least photographs of my children up on Facebook. A, because I don't want Facebook to have any ability to take those photos and use them for advertising, which happens from time to time. But more importantly, because I want my children to be able to control their own identity. I've had misgivings about posting even funny anecdotes about my kids on Facebook, which leads me to, in the last 5 minutes or so, a closing question. With regard to policymakers thinking about these issues, what is the main idea that you want policymakers to take from a book like this? I mean, recognizing that as you said at the beginning, the book is written for academics, but to the extent that policymakers are reading this material, and I would suggest that at least some staffers in legislatures might in fact pick up a book like this, what would you want them to take away?
I guess in addition to thinking more about the long-term risks, based on what you just pointed out, you know, being concerned with you know, putting embarrassing details about your children online. I think at a policy level, we should be having more conversations about not just the care for the self and not just sort of self-responsibility, you know, watching out for what you put up about yourself, but recognizing that social media, of course, is social. So I might put you in harm's way by uploading an embarrassing picture, or you could potentially end my career with a wall post. To say nothing of, you know, what could be done to more vulnerable populations like children. I think, you know, we have to think about the risks of harm in that very social way. So at a policy level, I mean, one example would be promoting media literacy, where it's not just a matter of, you know, don't harm yourself by doing this, but think about your neighbors, think about your friends, think about your children and your family when you post stuff. Do you think they would really consent to this? I think having the conversation framed in that way would definitely be helpful.
And all of this, of course, assumes that with regard to any protections that might exist, that Facebook isn't hacked or Facebook doesn't fold or this data falls into the hands of someone who couldn't care less about one's interests and whatever contractual relationship might exist between Facebook's users and its and the corporate entity. As a last question, Dan, you referred to it a couple of times. Your current work, what are you focusing on right now?
Right now, I'm looking at how social media is being used specifically by police and law enforcement. So myself and some colleagues elsewhere in Europe conducted this sort of cross-EU set of interviews with different privacy advocates, but also police officers and law enforcement specialists who focus on the use of social media technology. So just getting a sense of the current technology landscape, but also some of the dilemmas they're facing. I've also been looking at the notion of crowdsourcing in the context of surveillance online. So both of things like the there was a riot in Vancouver, of course, in typical Canadian fashion, is over a hockey game. Right after this, 100,000 people went on Facebook and posted all sorts of photos sort of in real time of the riot, and then other people would come on and identify it. And this is something, you know, I've never seen before. So myself and a colleague at the University of British Columbia, Christopher Schneider, have been focusing on this. But there's also cases that are more like a business orientation. So you have services in London like Internet Eyes, where if I'm a shopkeeper and I have CCTV cameras in my shop, I could then crowdsource the surveillance of those feeds to people in the UK and Canada, you know, anywhere, I think, in like the European Economic Exchange area. So legally, it poses a whole bunch of issues about putting this information out there. But what interests me is that you're seeing a real crowdsourcing of surveillance that would otherwise be more like the panopticon, you know, the one guard tower. So I'm wondering, you know, what happens when you sort of open up those possibilities of surveillance to the general population, you know, is it really empowering, or is it more a matter of just the conventional, regular kind of guard tower, panopticon power, but just sort of outsourced to different people?
Dan Trottier of the University of Westminster, author of the book Social Media Surveillance, Rethinking Visibility in a Converging World. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. It's been a terrific discussion. I look forward to following your work, and I invite you back on the show to continue these discussions down the road. But thank you again for joining us today on the show.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
This is the last show for the winter quarter on KZSU. Hearsay Culture will commence again with new shows beginning when the quarter begins in the second week, the new quarter, KZSU begins in the second week of April. And I am in the process over the next couple of weeks to both invite guests and set up that schedule. Some of those guests are already confirmed. Others I will be inviting. So I do welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback on guests at Dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live on KZSU. This quarter, it's been 9 a.m. Pacific time. However, that is subject to change in the next quarter. You can also listen to the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to Stanford's Center for Internet Society iTunes page, or by going to the webpage for Stanford Center for Internet Society at That's cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you for listening this quarter. This has been an exceptionally busy academic year, but I am looking forward to a bit of a break in terms of as intense a schedule once the summer commences. As much as I love teaching and being in a classroom, it also takes up a lot of time, which takes away from the radio show, as, to be clear, it should, given that my job is first to teach. But over the summer, I focus more on my research and scholarship, also giving me more time for the radio show, and so I'm looking forward to that as well. Again, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.